Thank you for listening to our Conversations About Change, bringing thoughtful perspectives on technology, society, and change to the net every week since October 2004. Here's this week's show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the 352nd Yi Tan Tech Community Call on Monday, October 19th, 2009. Yi Tan, in Mandarin, means conversations about change. I'm Jerry Mikulski, Yi Tan's founder. Today I'm in San Francisco, and my co-founder, Pip Coburn, is in New York. Every week, we take 30 to 35 minutes to discuss tech topics of interest to investors, executives, and tech-savvy folks like you. You can find supporting resources online at yitan.com, as well as links to a live chat using Internet Relay Chat. We tweet at the user ID yitan with no hyphen, Y-I-T-A-N, and we use the hash code #yitan. We also podcast, so you can listen to these conversations when you want to. This is an interactive call, which means we are all live. Please be mindful of this and don't put us on your musical hold. Instead, mute buttons are okay, or hit the *6 on your keypad. When you want to jump in, the *6 will also uncloak you, and then please say your name each time so we know who's speaking. Today's conversation about change takes us into our geek roots. The official launch date for Windows 7 is October 22, just a few days away. And a bunch of us, I think, have been using Windows 7 already for a while. The release candidate was out some time ago, and I will say that my experience has been, I would even stretch to say, vastly better than it was with Vista and before that with other versions of the Microsoft OS. So we have with us a couple people who've dialed in to talk with us about this, among them Chris Tuttle. And I thought maybe I'd start with you, Chris. And see, just overall, what's your take on Windows 7? What's really different about it? Is this just a rescue operation for Microsoft, or is it a game changer? Big plus, sort of a net zero, or what's your take? And you're still muted. There you are. Good.
Okay. Yeah, I just had to do that. I guess we're looking at this at a pretty a pretty basic level, which is, Microsoft has had a couple hands tied behind their back when, your core product, your OS, is kind of underwater, which Vista clearly underperformed expectations and left a lot of people on XP. And as someone sitting here with a bunch of screens in front of me, one of them being XP, the rest being Mac OS, XP, really is, obviously does not compare well. So I think there's clearly a consensus, and you said it right up front, that Windows 7 is absolutely usable, and some people, including some Mac-oriented reviewers, have been out there and said that it's actually fun to use and works well, and though they're not replacing Macs or anything like that, they don't need to. It's still the vast bulk of the market. A lot of folks have been waiting to move. And I think it represents what may be the beginning of a few, at least, not detrimental product cycles for Microsoft, this being the first, Office 10 being the next, and God forbid, a Windows 7 mobile that is not an embarrassment, could give them at least no more headwinds. And one indirect consequence of Google's aspirations is they've actually made the Windows platform a little bit more functional, given the fact that obviously you can download Google Chrome and have full access to the Google platform and software and service suite of tools on Windows as easily as anywhere else. So I'll leave it at that and give the other folks time to comment.
Thanks. Does anybody have any good estimate for how far short of expectations Vista fell? Was it expected to have a certain amount of upgrades in corporate, and was it expected to hit 50% and hit 20%, or are there any estimates for how badly Vista went off course? Oops, sorry, can't hear you yet.
Oh, I don't know.
There we go.
Sorry. I think it not surprisingly, Microsoft wasn't very forthcoming with it, and I think the fact that we also, on top of everything else, had the financial and economic malaise that we've had, probably muddies the water. But if I can find any information that's useful before the call's over, I'll share it.
Thank you. And if anybody else has any answer, please dive in. Gina DiNardo, are you on the call?
She's not here yet, but her team's here.
Oh, okay. Anybody from the team want to just kick in some ideas about what Vista means from your perspective? Sorry, what Windows 7 means from your perspective?
So, Marco, you're on the call. Do you want to answer this or?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, yes,
Todd from Germany's online.
Yeah, I just had to press the mute button while I'm driving. So, yeah, we think actually that Windows 7 might be the first next operating system after XP, which will hit the business quite high, and enterprises will migrate really soon to the new operating system. And one of the main reasons we think why that is happening is that the support contracts, of course, for Windows XP will more or less not end soon, but it's on the horizon that enterprises actually need to switch. And software vendors will definitely now future driver support and stuff like that, more or less like for Vista and Windows 7, and maybe cut their support for old operating systems. And what we think already, and we investigated a lot of time, you know, in supporting Windows 7 in our infrastructure, and we are right now piloting the operating system, and from the back-end infrastructure and all kind of management stuff, Windows 7 is actually a real step ahead, because you have, for example, native tablet functionality within the operating system. You can store drivers much more easily, and it's much easier than before. And from the user front end, of course, it's everything looks very nice and shiny, the arrow interface, the jump list, many more.
Yeah, they seem to have cleaned up a lot of things. And my first big win was when I closed the lid, it actually goes to sleep within about 10 seconds instead of a minute and a half. And I thought that was a big advantage.
Yeah. And also, what I know from, for example, from hardware vendors, that they are really investigated now for Windows 7. What kind of services are running, you know, and the driver support itself. So they went back to their driver vendors like Intel, the wireless LAN and video chipset drivers, that they forced Intel actually to rewrite their code to make the driver faster in Windows 7. That's what
I'm interesting.
Yeah.
Is this going to turn into any concrete benefits for users? Does this mean there's some new functionality that shows up that wasn't possible before because the interface to hardware was just too slow to deal with it?
No, it's actually more or less only pure performance what they are doing. So here I'm talking actually about Lenovo, which is our hardware vendor. And they, if you go to their website, they call it Windows 7 Enhanced Experience. So what they're promising is that they reduce, for example, the startup time with a Windows 7 image developed by Lenovo, yeah, and with their drivers by 50%. The shutdown time is in about 5 seconds. That's the time where the machine not supposed to stand by, it should shut down. Yeah, that's what they are promising. And on the 22nd of October, they are releasing all that stuff.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Was that someone else who wanted to jump into the conversation, or?
Jerry, this is Paul Oak. Sorry for the noise in the background, but I'd just like to ask the community that's on the call whether or not they think this is really a fundamental change from a, you know, essentially from a Windows consumer perspective. Do we really believe that this is different? You know, why should I believe that this is going to be just like Microsoft's promises about how much better Vista was going to be, that, you know, never really delivered on that promise?
Do we think that they really made some substantial change that means it's going to be different?
Anyone on the call want to jump in and answer that?
Yeah, this is Nathan Brookwood.
Please, Nathan.
And I think that I've been using Win7 since the beta, I guess. And boy, I am so impressed. I know that every time Microsoft has come out with a new operating system, at least since Windows 95, they gear up the PR machine and everybody thinks, gee, this is going to be the best thing since sliced bread. It's going to change the industry. And a month or two later, we're saying, just another operating system. But I think this time it actually could be different because they really have gotten so much right. Somebody just mentioned the Wi-Fi support. I'm super impressed with the way that when the system wakes up, it finds the Wi-Fi access points, especially if it's already had an established relationship with an access point before it went to sleep. Typically, before it can get the lit up all the way on the machine. And often, you know, since it'll put up a screen that says, hey, you've got to type in your password, by the time I got my password entered, it's already not only found the access point, but my email program was running. It's already pulled in all the latest emails. And that's something that I never saw before with XP or especially with Vista. So from my perspective, this is a much faster machine, especially on waking things. Also much more reliable. You know, a lot of people just don't use the sleep function because they know if they put their machine to sleep, the odds are that lots of times it won't wake up.
It's like Russian roulette, exactly.
Well, there are probably some people on here who may remember the original Star Wars program on the PDP-1 and the Jabber, which has been on the web forever. It had a feature called hyperspace. And every time you went into hyperspace to avoid a collision, the probability that you would exit from hyperspace intact that dropped. And sleep was a little bit like that. But I have machines now that I've been using regularly that go to sleep at night and wake up in the morning, or when I wake them up in the morning, they come back to life. And, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later, I find browser windows buried underneath the pile of rubbish on my desktop that are still there.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is something never had with the earlier products. And then in terms of functionality, something that I think is really important, I've been paying a lot of attention to, is the new Direct Compute features, which are part of DirectX 11, which basically allow applications to use the computational resources in reasonably powerful GPUs for tasks other than just playing games. And a lot of the major media-type applications from Adobe, from CyberLink, and Arcsoft take advantage of this. And one of the few applications that I know of that consumers do regularly that requires lots of computational resources is when they want to transcode a media file to move it, say, from whatever they downloaded it on their PC, format for an MP3 player. And
right.
That can take, half an hour sometimes. You know, you're happy if it takes better than if you do it better than in real time. And with these GPU boosts, they can speed that up by a factor of 3 to 5. So, and that just happens. It's built in. It's part of the drag and drop. If it sees that there is a transcoding process and you have a GPU that can support it, that just happens. And so things like that, I believe, are really going to make a difference. Because for most users today, you know, the PC is fast enough. Nobody complains that their PC is too slow unless they're doing media-intensive things. And
a lot of stuff.
Things are high. And therefore, GPUs can make a difference.
Exactly. Dean is pointing out on the IRC that this tends to be the peak of Microsoft arrogance. You know, we put it out there, you're all going to buy it, and we will update it when we want to. And that just backfired. And I totally agree. And to Paul's question about is this really different, and also your answer, I think it's hugely different just because the initial leak is that it really does work, and it's really a big improvement. And it's almost... Please, somebody forgive me for saying this. It's almost as if Steve Jobs joined Microsoft for a while, went backstage, and the perfectionist in him demanded that the engineers actually get these things right. Because for so many years, for decades, Microsoft has been shipping software that requires other software to actually run right, or that is disappointing, or that is slow, or that is insanely developed, where with, you know, dialogues that conflict with each other, that where you just never know where to change your communication settings, other sorts of things. And it seems like this is at least a pretty good faith, high performance effort out of that. Now we talked a little bit about Office 10 up front, which could be another big revenue boost for Microsoft. I'm not that excited about Office 10. Is anybody really excited about Office 10? Does that look like it's going to be another big win, or are we just going to see more adoption of the current levels of Office?
Hey, Jerry, it's Pip. Could I make one quick comment before we move on?
Of course, Pip, please.
The one thing that I noticed that is somewhat different in the last really 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, is that Steve Ballmer and company are presenting 7 as a do more with less product that will generate ROI. In other words, you don't have to buy it just because it's, you know, got new bells and whistles and all that. We understand the environment you're in. This is actually going to help you save money. Now then, you know, turning that into some real math is a little bit more difficult, but it's much more sensitive of Microsoft understanding the environment in which they're selling things, that no, our thing isn't the hottest thing on the block. People aren't going to do it just because they're doing it. They don't want to go to their boss and tell them it's just better. They got to have more ammunition than that and understand that the person we're selling to, their boss, is not a desktop hugger or anything like that. They're going to want money out of this sucker.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that really being a change in their direction of marketing and promotion, which is definitely on track with the realities of the world, I think.
Hey, it's funny that this is Eric from Barron's. Hi.
Hey, Eric.
So, just to follow up on what Pip was saying, I think you're right about that, but I think it also addresses what is Wall Street's big hope here, which is that not just that, you know, Microsoft will have a better success with this than with Vista, but that this will drive sales of drive a replacement cycle in PCs. And of course, that hope comes at a time when IT spending has been extremely tight, and for now remains tight. There have been some, you know, little hints that maybe things were getting a little bit looser, but for now remains a real question: is whether this is good enough. Whether this is compelling enough, perhaps generates enough ROI, as you suggested, to drive people to buy new hardware. I think that's a question on which a lot, from an investment standpoint, a lot bears on the answer to that question. And I'm not sure what the answer is going to turn out to be. So
I'll throw in my 2 cents, Eric. I think that's just crazy thinking out of Wall Street that is really not checked by common sense or looking at past cycles. One of the things that's interesting about 7 is so many people will be able to upgrade without upgrading the hardware. When we went to Vista, it was almost mandatory that you did a hardware upgrade because your PC couldn't handle the upgrade. In this case, I think there'll be a number of people that will go out of their way to upgrade the software and not upgrade the hardware. Anything compelling enough to create a massive upgrade cycle, I think people that are thinking that in a world where we already sell, 320 million desktops or laptops a year in the world, anyone thinking that number is going to be somehow significantly inflated because of this, I think is living on a different planet.
Yeah, I would add myself
on the line.
Let me just add one thing, which is that if you look last week at some of the earnings reports and listen to some of the conference calls from the semiconductor industry. Some of them talked about big buildups of PC units going into the Windows 7 launch. AMD in particular talked about this on their call last week, where they said that they gave guidance for Q4 that was somewhat below seasonal expectations, and that's one reason why that stock got hit pretty hard on Friday. And that what they said basically was that there was a big buildup of PCs by the OEMs in Q3. And it suggests to me, it's something I wrote about in the magazine this week, that expectations may have gotten a little out of control for what Win 7 is going to mean in terms of PC sales, and therefore perhaps some issues for the semiconductor industry too, short term. Hi, this is Eddie from McKinsey & Company. I just want to interject. If we take a look at the landscape, if we go back to when we had XP and Vista, the landscape was a little bit different in that when Microsoft released Vista, they said this is mandatory, you need to do this, and basically you shoved it down everyone's throat that you have to do this, and the community reacted because it's not because necessarily the forcing of that, but the crunching of the timelines for Vista, people didn't anticipate the application compatibility. So enterprises mm-hmm. who had applications that were built for XP, Windows 2000, and some of them even prior with legacy code would have to essentially add testing schedules for all their applications as well as migration schedules for all those applications to be compatible with Vista. Now, with Windows 7 and Vista being out for a couple of years, that's allowed people to and also vendors and OEMs to develop applications and compatibility updates for Vista, and Vista code will actually run fine on Windows 7. So what that has done is bought time in terms of the application vendors and OEMs to catch up with the architecture. And so that's mm-hmm. probably another reason why Windows 7 might have a better uptake than with Vista, because now that additional amount of time with vendors, especially like security products like antiviruses and things like that, now have the ability to run on Windows 7.
So I've got a question here for everyone, which is, I think there are two forces, and I don't know how to quantify these two forces. One force is, what is the pent up energy for new laptops in particular? Because nobody's really buying desktops anymore. Maybe they're buying net something or others. But what is the pent up demand in corporations to buy these things? Because I think a lot of people have been nursing, partly because of the financial downturn, partly because of Vista's boondoggle. They've been on XP machines with old hardware for a very long time now, and they're happy to upgrade. And the second force here is, how netbook friendly is Win 7? If you've got a 1 gig RAM machine and a tiny keyboard and stuff like that, are you going to not want to do it? Some of the netbooks are actually getting up to almost 92%, 93% keyboard size. They'll probably be at 100% real soon with low-power processors, but a $500 price tag. Why wouldn't you throw away the old, the old Toshiba satellite running XP or whatever it is in favor of that? So, anybody with any thoughts on those two forces?
Well, if you take a this is Eddie again from McKinsey. Take a look at the netbook hardware itself, it's still a day and night difference in terms of capability. And even if you talk with Intel or Lenovo, HP, they will also reiterate that the netbook is not meant to be, a laptop replacement. If you look from apples and oranges, the hardware is quite different. A standard laptop will be a dual-core machine running at approximately 2 gigahertz with a significant amount of cache on machine, which as a result of that will perform quite admirably. If you look at a netbook, it's a single-core machine running a 1.6 gigahertz chip, which is akin to a machine that was released around 2001. Mm-hmm. So if you could picture people running today Windows XP on a machine that's almost 10 years old, and you give them a netbook, the performance is going to be comparable to that. Expectations are going to be limited, especially in the fact that netbooks have a cap of 2 gigs of memory that they're allowed to address. That's one caveat. The other caveat is applications in terms of how users use them. Okay, if they're doing web browsing and some office applications, it might be good. But if you have network-centric applications and you have a very mobile user force, such as a Salesforce or something of that nature, it may not be the best or optimal solution.
Hey, Jerry, this is Eric. I actually have a slightly different view about netbooks, which is, I think what in terms of the corporate users, I think that's certainly true that netbooks are probably not a solution that is going to satisfy, a corporate user. But I actually do think that in the consumer space, that they are going to be good enough for a lot of people, and I think you see that in the unit volumes in netbooks in recent months, and in what you're going to see next year. I actually think that when you look at the way the average consumer, the casual user is using what they're doing on their computer, it's mostly the web, email, maybe a little word processing, maybe they're watching some video or something. But I think for the most part, that covers a lot of what the average consumer is doing on their device, and their ability to buy one that is both cheap and easily portable is going to be extremely compelling. And they will run Windows 7, so that's not going to be an issue. I mean, Microsoft has stressed that, and I've seen some reviews that have suggested it's not a problem. It runs fine on netbooks. So, I think that it is true that the PC OEMs downplay as much as they can, the attractiveness of netbooks. I saw Michael Dell give a talk a week or so ago here, and he was sort of talking about how the experience isn't that good. You know, the screen size is small, the processor speeds are slower, et cetera. And I think that's all true as far as it goes. But I think for a lot of people, for more applications than the PC industry is really comfortable with, this is going to be good enough to solve the needs of a lot of people, particularly in an environment when, consumer spending is still going to be tight, even with, even coming out of a recession. We have high unemployment. We have, people have taken a huge hit to their net worth through, the downturn in both the stock market and the housing market. And I think that they're going to sell like crazy, and it's a real challenge for the PC industry to manage their profitability expectations for their PC businesses in the face of consumers flocking to buy $200, $300, $400 machines.
I'm with you on that, Eric, and I think that the difference between a 2 gigahertz plus clock and 1.6 gigahertz really isn't that much, and the dual core comes in really great if you need to offload some processing to do something else, but there aren't that many things where you need to do that unless you're editing video or doing something else. It also takes a lot of power. So I think good enough might be pretty good. And if you can plug an external monitor and an external keyboard into a device that may not have a suitable keyboard for somebody's full-time use, you've got a desktop replacement. It sounded like somebody was clearing their throat to jump in there. Jump on in.
This is Gina DiNardo from McKinsey & Company. How are you?
Hi, Gina. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I think that you're right. The next generation of the netbooks will be suffice for certain groups. Not only, I actually agree with the consumer market, obviously, but I think there will be niche markets in terms of, executives that are highly mobile, emerging markets, as well as, people that are moving around, obviously, the pharmaceutical and other industries that require small devices to send and receive information. But I think that the next generation will be able to support a number of enterprise applications, which maybe the first generation was not able to do so well. I think that it really will depend on what type of applications you're running, and I think that there'll have to be some testing, obviously, at the if it's going to be used in a corporate environment at that level. But certainly, I agree with, that the technology is moving forward, and I think that the vendors are, trying to meet the needs of, the financial situation and, make the margins, et cetera. And I think that the keyboards are going to be, not as much of an issue in terms of moving up in size. So over 90%. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I think that there may be a market for it in the enterprise, and certainly in the enterprise in emerging areas.
Is cloud computing going to play a reasonably big role here in offloading the demand for processing power on the device that's in front of the user? I mean, are we going to be doing more and more things? When you use your iPhone to do Google Voice or to use the Google search, it basically samples your voice, sends it off to recognition in the cloud, and then come back answers. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. Or is that just too slow a movement to bother this trend right now? And that question's for anybody who's been jumping in.
Well,
I mean, this is Eric. You know, I would say that in a sense, people are getting more used to having some of their key functionality in the cloud, right? So, I mean, especially if you're talking about a device that's mostly being used for web and email access, I don't think it's going to be a problem. And I think that, you know, this is a device that lives, that succeeds in large part because of the increasing ubiquity of connectivity, right? So, you know, this would not be a very good device to have sitting on your desk all day. But if you're, you know, if you're mobile, whether as a consumer or as a as a professional, that's where it becomes valuable. It's the portability, it's the low cost, and it is the expectation that you can get connectivity and reach email, web, or perhaps through the web, corporate information, other kinds of information. So I think that in a sense you're right. I mean, the cloud, this is probably a good topic for another call, but I think that the idea that a lot of the information you need is on the out on the network, and that you can get on the network with relative ease as you travel around, makes it that much more compelling with a device that kind of slips easily into your backpack, your briefcase. My 13-year-old son brings one to school every day, brings it home, plugs it in to a larger monitor and a keyboard. It does exactly what you were describing, and the performance is fine. It's not a solution for everyone. It's not a power user solution. You probably wouldn't want to do it if you were, editing video and doing other things that were pretty computationally intensive.
Right.
Where you needed the power on the desktop, because it's not there. But I think you're right. I think that as there is more functionality in the cloud, and it's a little bit it's a little bit insidious, right? I mean, because if you think about the way people use social networking applications, either to communicate or to store photos or to share video or do other kinds of things. All that depends on access to the cloud and the information stored not on your own machine, but out in the ether someplace. So
totally. And if you talk to Richard Stallman or Jonathan Zittrain or any of those people, they're basically trying to warn us off the deck of the carrier here that we don't want all our data to be living on other third-party servers because it puts us at a very vulnerable position. So I understand that as well.
With the danger server outage recently, right, where the people with using the Sidekick from Danger had Microsoft server goes down, and they basically it looks for at least for a little while like all this user data was going to get just wiped out because it was,
right.
If you didn't have it backed up on your, on your local device, you're going to lose all this material in the cloud. So I think that's a legitimate question to ask, right? Was how much do we trust having information out there? But that's we're getting a little far afield.
Sure. One more question about other possible competitors or entries here. Does anybody give Chrome OS any kind of possibility of making a dent in this market? Maybe there might be netbooks or regular laptops shipping with Chrome OS instead of Windows. Is that any kind of a realistic threat, or is that just not going to take much market or get much grip? Anybody feel strongly about Google's Chrome OS?
Well, I don't want to be done with talking here, but I will say that it's too early, I think, to really expect to have a huge dent. I don't think in the near term you're going to run into people sort of not buying Windows machines so that they can buy buy computers based on Chrome OS. It's certainly not going to be an issue in the enterprise for the foreseeable future. Is there a point out there where it's a possibility? Yeah. Is there a time when, there might be sufficient cost savings by doing that, where some people will want to do that as opposed to, buying Windows-based netbooks? Sure, it's a possibility. I will point out that, a lot of the early generation netbooks were Linux-based, and that was part of the cost savings, right? That it was a cheaper OS.
Exactly.
But it turns out that people didn't want them. People wanted the more familiar environment.
Now, you know, Google's not, I mean, there's a difference between adopting Chrome and adopting Linux, but I think it's a little early. You know, we'll need to see proof, I think, that it's an acceptable solution before it.
Are Microsoft's licensing terms for notebooks different from laptops, or are we still paying the same licensing fee on the smaller machine at a lower price point?
Well, I don't know if somebody else knows the answer to this, but I will say that I think in general that their licensing terms relate to a percentage of the selling price. So, you know, so it's not just, I don't think it's just a flat per, you know, per, I think it depends on the price at which the unit sells. So, you know, they get less per unit on netbooks than they do on more powerful desktop machines. I think, at least that's my understanding.
Okay, if anybody knows...
It's Pip again. You made a reference that buying Chrome OS wouldn't be like buying Linux, but I wasn't sure exactly what your inference was.
Oh, I guess what I'm sort of getting at is whether having it kind of branded as a Google OS maybe makes some people more comfortable using a Windows alternative. Than using Linux, which may be branded with something that sort of Ubuntu is sort of a geeky brand. I mean, it's possible that that's more appealing to some people. I don't think in the short run it's very likely that they gain very much traction. Would be my sort of instinct.
Mm-hmm.
Eric, sorry for cutting you off, Eddie.
All right. A long time ago, I was on IBM ThinkPad advisory board, and for years, I was trying to get them to build a legacy-free Linux laptop, just as a playpen, basically throw away all the ports, all the drivers, throw away everything really except, you know, Ethernet and Wi-Fi. And you can talk to Bob Frankston about his efforts to get Microsoft not to do a whole series of proprietary connectors and other kinds of oddball connectors, but throw away everything that wasn't, and throw away all the DRM, by the way, because we're paying for a lot of chips that are on board these machines just trying to protect content, which is pretty much unprotectable. But throw away everything that was keeping the hot air balloon from really sort of taking off and achieving better battery life, better performance, and in particular, lower cost and less complexity. And with Vista, I thought that was really urgent because the complexity seemed to be getting the better of the equation. Windows 7 makes me feel like, well, maybe Microsoft's got that under control again somehow, and it's not so necessary. And the day for a legacy-free Linux laptop is probably past. But I wouldn't underestimate the user-friendliness of a machine that knows how to boot to a browser that doesn't really look like Linux of any flavor. It may not look like Ubuntu or like anything. It may just look like a happy Google machine. And I would think that would be very, very simple and maybe incredibly appealing. And the licensing terms might shave another, you know, $50-$70 off of these already very cheap cheap platforms. So I don't know that it's going to happen anytime soon. I think that, you know, Eric saying it's too early to know is, you know, totally dead on, of course. But I give them more odds maybe than the rest of us on the call here. Any other thoughts on Win 7 in particular and how this is going to play out? I'm particularly curious if anybody thinks that Windows 7 Mobile will be any good. I've been a long-time detractor of all Windows Mobile from when it started as Windows CE, and I don't expect them to do anything good with Windows Mobile except for continually hold some share because they're Microsoft. But any take on the mobile version or just other ideas on Windows 7? Anybody who wants to dive on in?
Well, actually, this is Chris Tuttle again. I just wanted to, this is a great discussion. A couple of things I wanted to note is that the whole netbook phenomenon, and this is, I guess, really just opinion, but I think that pretty soon that'll be a distinction without a difference.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, there will be netbooks running Windows 7 in a couple weeks. And, you know, we've got all manner of netbooks and laptops here. And if you go into a retail establishment now, you know, the laptop prices and models have come down. So you'll have netbooks stretching up to, you know, 400 and change. And then you start to look at the low-end Sony laptops at, you know, 500-600. And it's a normal consumer experience. You know, they're saying, well, for another $100, would you like to have a DVD and video and a bigger screen, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, notwithstanding the fact that, yes, inside there's an Atom and there's there's maybe an NVIDIA GPU, you know, and there's different form factors. I think those lines are going to blur. And, you know, to come back to our discussion, I mean, I think that, you know, Microsoft has proven that, you know, things like, you know, all the hardware device drivers and all that kind of stuff, I don't think that's a business many people want to be in. And if you want to, if you're Google, you might be happy to have, you know, Microsoft handling the raw OS down on the metal, and then you just have someone click a button and download Chrome and maybe a bunch of other supporting client software features. So I think there are going to be people will go at it a little bit differently, but I think at least at the, you know, kind of that hardware layer, Microsoft is going to have a better foundation to try to guard and build their you know, their IE and their apps business that they haven't had before, you know, because XP mm-hmm. is while we were on the phone call, I don't know that any of these numbers are reliable, but, you know, Forrester and a bunch of people have, at least that I can see, have been rather vocally, you know, pointing out that, you know, the vast, you know, the majority, that is, you know, more than 50% of enterprises have, you know, are waiting. You know, they're still on XT, and some of those numbers are as high as 70%. So there's, you know, there's a large base of the installed population that, you know, thinks Outlook is the only email client out there in the world, or that mm-hmm. IE is the only browser. And a lot of those folks have been waiting. So while it may not contribute to overall unit volume growth, you know, it's going to present some interesting dynamics, I think, for Microsoft that'll be better.
Yeah. Chris, thank you. When you said they're waiting on XP, I kind of just for a moment misheard XT. And that
oh, no, I'm sorry. They're sitting there with XP waiting. For.
No. It was just my imagination running wild. You totally sounded like you said XP. I know that. But boy, that threw me way back.
Oh, yeah.
For the PCAT. Any last words from anybody about Win 7? I think we're generally agreed here that Microsoft has finally sort of rescued itself from this bad rep with Vista, and they're delivering something that seems to really work. And where Pip says that he's impressed with their different marketing approach here, I think partly that's because they don't actually have to oversell a bad OS now. The OS is going to pull its weight in the marketplace, and now what they can say is there's a ROI and this is going to work, and they can totally take a different tack instead of pulling out the heavy, you know, the heavy barrage of public relations and marketing. And as Dean was saying on the chat, you know, we are Microsoft, you will buy this because we're going to force you to. So I think we're pretty sanguine about Win 7's future. I'm not sure that any of the other things we brought up in the call look as positive. And if I'm wrong, please jump in and correct me. But any last words from anybody who was jumping in, or anyone else who'd like to add something?
Aaron? Hi,
yeah.
Aaron, Nathan again.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, we've had both call and nobody has talked at all about stability. And yet, you know, one of the historic criticisms of Windows is blue screens of death. And I can say, you know, somebody who's been using this thing for months, pretty steady, blue screens are extremely rare. I think I've had two or three in the entire
mm-hmm.
period I've been running pages and release candidate. So this thing is absolutely solid, and that should be a big factor in terms of being able to start to turn around Microsoft's reputation for flaky software.
Thanks, Nathan. I agree with that. Anyone else? Last words. Otherwise, let me recap and take us out of today's call. So we started with Chris Tuttle jumping in and saying that Microsoft has sort of been working for a long time with a couple of hands tied behind his back, that Vista's entry left a lot of companies on XP and a lot of people on XP and a lot of switching to Mac OS. And he says, look, I've got a bunch of screens in front of me. One of them is XP and the rest are all Mac OS. And that Microsoft is now at the beginning of some really possibly positive cycles, certainly the Windows 7 cycle, but he also points to Office 10 coming up and the future release of Windows 7 Mobile. And there may be a lot of things that look good for Microsoft's earnings here. And he says that Google's advances may, in fact, have forced this. And we didn't talk at all during the call about search, and I still find it deeply ironic that if you want good, fast search of what the documents on your machine, your best answer is to install the Google Desktop Search. But actually, Microsoft seems to be getting its act together here. And we don't really have any good financial and economic numbers for how much Vista left money on the table for Microsoft and how much pent-up demand there is of companies on XP. But toward the end of the call, Chris jumped back in and said that Forrester and others are saying that there's probably half of the enterprises out there, maybe even as much as 70% of them, are busy sitting on XP waiting for something that will let them migrate off and move. So part of what's happening is that support for XP is going to end soon, which had been threatened for a very long time, but then was forced back open by Vista's failure, effectively. And so a lot of companies really need to switch right now. Marker from McKinsey called us while driving over there, and he said, look, this is really the next OS after XP, and their enterprises will be migrating here. This looks like a good thing. And he points out that XP support leaves pretty soon, and the companies need to switch. And they've been piloting Windows 7, and the back-end management looks really good. It's a huge step ahead. There's native tablet support built in, and I think there's a lot of people who enjoy tablets, even if we haven't found out what the tablet habit is like yet as a sort of PC user culture. And the drivers are much easier to install. For users, it looks nice and shiny. The Aero interface doesn't need all your computing resources, but still looks really good. It doesn't have a lot of sharp edges to it. It really works. And hardware vendors are heading toward it in droves. They're updating drivers. They're speeding things up. Video drivers, Intel is speeding up its own drivers. And McKinsey's vendor, Lenovo, is promising a Windows 7 enhanced experience with 50% faster driver in many cases and 5 seconds to shut down when you ask for it. And he was also saying that, yes, please.
I apologize. It's Pip. In terms of the support, my understanding is that the support on XP runs till 2014. I could be wrong on that, but I understand that you could buy Vista, downgrade to XP, and be assured all the way to 2014. So for people might want to dig into that on their own. I just mentioned that.
That sounds great.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Pip. And that may well be the new deal that was struck when Vista basically faltered, was extending the life of it. So that would be a good thing to look into. Thank you. Then Paul Oakes jumped in and said, well, look, is this really a fundamental change? Is this really, really different? And I think a bunch of people said, yes, it seems to be really different, partly from use. Nathan Gripwit jumped in and said, look, he's been using Windows 7 since the early betas, and he's very, very impressed. You know, usually when Microsoft launches some new OS, the PR machine gears up and there's a pretty big disappointment. This time seems to be very different. And he pointed to Wi-Fi support, which is vastly better, reliability, and toward the end of the call, he came back in and talked about stability. He said, look, blue screens of death are very, very rare here. This thing is solid already. So there's also some new direct compute features that let you use the GPU, the graphics processor, for other tasks if you need to transcode media or do other kinds of things, which is great. So that seems to be really a positive trend. So Pip said, look, in the last 3 or 4 weeks, he's noticed that Steve Ballmer has been presenting Windows 7 as a do more with less platform and really talking about ROI. And it seems like the OS is fulfilling enough of the promise here that they can take a different angle. Eric Savitz from Barron's jumped in and talked about, you know, this is Wall Street's big hope, that this is going to drive sales of PCs and there will be a big replacement cycle. And yet IT dollars are very, very tight. So Pip says, well, this is kind of crazy thinking for Wall Street. There's lots of software upgrades possible here without hardware upgrades. You don't need to buy the brand new machine that Vista forced you to buy in order to get into Windows 7. So they may hold off on that. Chris Tuttle talked about last week's earnings reports from some of the semiconductor companies that they see that there have been big buildups by the OEMs in the third quarter of 2009, and that they're actually lowering guidance for the next quarter, and AMD's stock was hit because they lowered some guidance for the next quarter. Then Eddie from McKinsey talked about how this is really a different, you know, the old XP Vista landscape is really different from what's going on here, and that Vista was made mandatory, and everybody basically barfed on that. Eddie didn't actually use the word barf, but I think it's a nice shorthand for what happened in the marketplace when Microsoft tried to force Vista on everybody. And he says that netbooks, I started asking the question, well, what happens, how much pent-up demand is there in companies that still need to switch off of XP, and what will netbooks do to this? And then later I asked, what will the cloud do to this? What will those forces do? And he spent a bit of time in the middle of the call talking about netbooks, and he says, netbooks are still a day and night difference from what a real computer does. A normal computer has dual-core processor, 2 gigahertz plus, and some cache. And your average netbook is one core processor, 1.6 gigahertz, and maximum of 2 gigs of memory. And it's sort of like going back to a 2001 vintage machine. So they're not meant to be replacements for what people are doing. They may be good for very mobile people or very, very net-centric applications, but probably not ready for enterprise. But there was some disagreement about that. Eric Savitz jumped back in and said, look, netbooks may not be a satisfactory replacement for corporations today, but for consumers in the retail market, they're totally good enough, and you're seeing this in the numbers, that they're being bought like crazy. And if the average person is just doing web, email, a little bit of video watching, and some word processing, they're done, and in the next few weeks, there'll be some netbooks that are actually running Windows 7 actively. So the PC vendors are really downplaying netbooks, like Michael Dell recently did, but this doesn't mean that there's effectively going to be a distinction without a difference, as Chris said a little bit later, that what's going to happen is that the laptop market will creep down, the netbook market will creep up, and we'll end up with less and less difference between them, and this will just be a series of choices for what kind of processing you want at what price. Gina DiNardo jumped in and said that probably those next-generation netbooks will suffice for a lot of people in niche applications, probably, maybe for mobile executives or emerging markets or very mobile workers, and that the enterprise apps in another rev will be okay. They'll actually work all right on these things. If you plug it into a nice monitor, a nice keyboard, you've actually got a machine. Eric mentioned that people are getting used to the cloud and that it's better for mobile apps. It's sort of insidious. It kind of crawls in and takes over your life, but really depends on access. And we've had some very notable outages recently. Gmail was down for a while because of Google bobbling. Sidekick, people thought they'd lost all their data because Microsoft didn't manage the backups very well for the danger servers. There's a bunch of stuff like that going on that makes us all a little bit nervous about the cloud, but still, things are relentlessly moving into the cloud. And then I asked about Chrome OS and whether that's going to do anything, and Eric said, well, it's really too early and probably it's not going to do anything in the enterprise. But remember that early networks were all Linux machines and people didn't use them. People didn't want Ubuntu or Debian or other kinds of Linux distros. They really kind of wanted Windows there. And it sounds like the Microsoft license fees for Windows are proportional to the sales price of the device. So as more netbooks are sold, the per unit revenue to Microsoft will go down, but maybe we'll see almost a disposable, you know, people might have several netbooks or go through them in greater numbers. So we talked a little bit more about Chrome OS and the notion that full branding might actually bring some comfort to people. I think that a device that just wakes up and knows about the web and knows about how to search and how to run web apps with some JavaScript and Flash might be really appealing. So I'm actually more optimistic than most of us on this. Then Chris Tuttle talked about this distinction without a difference and how the lines are going to blur, and brought in some of the Forrester research for us. And toward the end of the call, Nathan mentioned that, you know, stability is really important here, and it seems like they've really hit this one solidly in the park, if not out of the park. That brings us to the end of Windows 7, the 252nd Yitan Tech Community Call, held on Monday, October 19th, 2009. Thank you, Nathan. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Gina. Thank you, Marco. Thank you, Chris. Thank you all for jumping in. You made it all a very fun and informative call. Feel free to add comments on patreon.com, and please tell your colleagues to join us again next Monday, and we'll talk about DIY City with its founder, John Geraci. I'm Jerry Mikulski. Thanks again, and until next week, goodbye, everybody.
This podcast is published under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 license. It was edited and published by Sasha Mercailo. Thanks again for listening.